Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. These days, supermarket shelves are brimming with soy breads and corn pastas, anything to replace gluten, the molecule that plagues those with celiac disease. A recent study has shown a link between intestinal infections and the disease, but diagnosis can still be tricky, forcing many to live for years with a chronically upset stomach or worse. For others, the threat is even more ominous. Here to shed some light on the topic is Dr. Sonia Kupfer of the Center for Clinical Cancer Genetics and the Celiac Center at the University of Chicago. Welcome, Dr. Kupfer.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
First, let's just talk about what gluten is. It's more than just, you know, wheat, right?
Right. So gluten is a molecule that's found in wheat, rye, and barley. And it's a particular part of gluten that in people who are genetically susceptible, those who have and develop celiac disease, this triggers an autoimmune response and causes damage in the small intestine.
What happens in the body if you have celiac disease and you eat gluten? What actually is the response of your body?
Yeah, so you basically have to have ingestion of gluten, and the gluten gets to the small intestine, and there the body sort of mounts an immune response and causes damage of the small intestine. And the small intestine is a very long organ, and we need it to absorb nutrients and vitamins, and that basically gets destroyed and flattened down. And as a result, you have some nutrients that don't get into your system, and that can cause some of the gastrointestinal symptoms, as well as some of the other symptoms, such as iron deficiency anemia or osteoporosis.
What is the difference between gluten sensitivity and celiac disease?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of terms that have been thrown around. Celiac disease is the disease where people are diagnosed with the autoimmune condition. So they have blood tests that are consistent with celiac disease. They have a biopsy in some cases of the small intestine that shows this damage. And then they get better when they go on a strict gluten-free diet. Gluten sensitivity is a more broad term, and we're now coming around to the fact that there is an entity known as non-celiac gluten sensitivity. These are individuals who have identified gluten as something that causes a myriad of symptoms, but we have ruled out celiac disease. But these individuals do seem to do better when they're on a gluten-free diet in terms of their symptoms.
If celiac disease goes untreated, what's the ultimate? Will it kill you?
Well, celiac disease causes a lot of symptoms that are very uncomfortable, mm-hmm. and lead to diminished quality of life. So classic symptoms include diarrhea and weight loss. Individuals can have iron deficiency anemia. They can have decreased bone density. And then there's also some other neurological symptoms. People can have numbness and tingling in their hands and feet. They can have what's called a brain fog. Small minority of cases can celiac that's been undiagnosed and the inflammation has been going on for years, can things like cancer develop.
Okay.
So it can be serious, but for the vast majority of individuals, it causes really a diminished quality of life.
My guest is Dr. Sonia Kupfer. She's an assistant professor of medicine, section of gastroenterology in the Center for Clinical Cancer Genetics at the University of Chicago. We're talking about celiac disease and gluten sensitivity today. Give us a call if you have a question, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. There was a recent study co-authored by doctors at the Mayo Clinic that found that gastroenteritis might light the fuse, as they put it, that triggers celiac disease. What do they mean by that, and can infections prime for an allergy?
Yeah, so this is a very important study that looked at individuals in the U.S. military, and this is a generally healthy population, and using medical claims, a database, basically, they looked at individuals who were diagnosed with celiac disease and then looked back to see if in the years prior to their diagnosis, they had any claims filed for infectious gastroenteritis and found that individuals who were diagnosed with celiac disease did in fact have higher rates of infectious gastroenteritis and specifically non-viral causes. We know that there has to be another hit that in order for celiac to develop. So everybody that has celiac disease needs to have the genetic predisposition, which are types of molecules called HLA. But about 30% of the population walking around has the same configuration, the same genetic predisposition. Mm-hmm. But only less than 5% of those individuals will ever go on to develop celiac. So that's where that second hit comes in. So you need to have something else, like you said, that lights the fire, that sort of primes the system. And infections are, you know, a very likely cause because what they do is they can make the gut even more leaky than it normally is, perhaps leading to higher loads of gluten. And in those individuals that have that genetic susceptibility, this may just be enough to trigger that autoimmune reaction. And I just wanted to make a point. You talked about, you know, this being an allergy. There is a concept known as wheat allergy, but that's we think an entirely different kind of process. That's okay. Where individuals have allergic reactions. So they get hives, they get nausea, they get vomiting immediately upon ingestion of gluten. Celiac disease is really more in the autoimmune category. And so we like to make that distinction because the treatment, while it includes avoiding gluten, is sort of a very different kind of pathway.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment. Is a gluten-free diet beneficial to people who do not have celiac disease, who are not gluten sensitive and don't fall into that? So just a regular, what do you call normal these days? But just someone who decides, well, I've heard gluten's bad for you, so I'm not going to eat it anymore.
Yeah, in general, no. A gluten-free diet is not healthier. In fact, it is missing some important nutrients that other fortified foods that contain gluten have, so things like B vitamins. So in general, for the average individual who does not have gastrointestinal symptoms, for example, a gluten-free diet is really not necessary. As I mentioned, there is this concept of non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So individuals who have been, for example, diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome that has a lot of, you know, loose stools and diarrhea associated with it, these individuals may benefit from going on a gluten-free diet, but I would caution people that really the important thing is to get tested for celiac disease properly, and that means staying on gluten, meeting with your doctor, having the blood test, and in some cases a biopsy done before you decide to go gluten-free. Because once you go gluten-free, it's much more difficult to make the diagnosis because the body is not, you know, sort of seeing gluten anymore, and so we don't know if individuals may have had celiac disease and have now improved, or if they have more of this non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So if you're considering it, please see your doctor so that proper testing can be done.
When you talk about missing nutrients, if you're not eating gluten because you think it's just bad for you, you could be missing other important nutrients. What does somebody with celiac disease or sensitivity do to get those nutrients themselves?
Yeah, so I recommend for all my patients who are on a gluten-free diet to take a multivitamin. There's a lot of gluten-free multivitamins available nowadays, and that's sufficient for most individuals. Some people who have more severe presentations with a lot of malnutrition may need to have additional supplementation, or individuals who have osteoporosis in some cases will recommend extra calcium and vitamin D, for example. The other thing that a gluten-free diet tends not to have a lot of is fiber. And so I do recommend that individuals try and get as much fiber as possible. And one way people can get more fiber is to ingest oats. But I'll make the point that there you want to make sure that they're pure oats. So oats themselves, in the vast majority of individuals, do not cause symptoms. But the problem is they get processed in facilities that also process gluten, and there can be cross-contamination. But there's a lot of companies now that process pure oats. And so oats are a good way to get more fiber in the gluten-free diet.
Bob in Thornville. You're on the air with Dr. Sonia Kupfer. Welcome, Bob.
Yes, thank you. Hi, doctor. Just to sound like there's a lot of similarities between celiac and then some of the peripheral neuropathy issues with knees, ankles, you mentioned brain fog. And a lot of times it seems like the best way to determine some of these things is the process of elimination, but you're suggesting there's a test. I feel like I've had every test under the sun for this peripheral neuropathy, but are those two sometimes confused or?
Yeah, so there is a neuropathy that can be associated with celiac, has been described with celiac disease, involving usually the hands and feet. Other neurological conditions associated with celiac is something known as gluten ataxia. Ataxia is when an individual has trouble maintaining their balance. And then there's some other symptoms such as brain fog in children. There can sometimes be behavioral issues, attention problems. So I have patients who have come to me who have as their primary complaint, peripheral neuropathy. And I do recommend testing with first blood tests. And there are a few blood tests that are, very good for the diagnosis. One is called tissue transglutaminase. And these are antibody tests. So what you're looking for is the body's immune reaction to gluten. And in cases of peripheral neuropathy, in most cases, the symptoms can be minimized if it's associated with celiac disease. But I found that sometimes they don't go away 100%, as, for example, sometimes the gastrointestinal symptoms might. So it's definitely something to consider. Now, there are other causes for peripheral neuropathy, so not everything is due to gluten. But I think that what we are learning more and more about celiac disease is it really has a lot of different kinds of manifestations. And what physicians learned in medical school even 10 years ago was that celiac only presented with severe diarrhea, weight loss, people were malnourished. It happened mostly in children. And we're coming around to the fact that there are many more presentations, many more subtle presentations of celiac disease, including neurological manifestations, for example, or even no manifestations. And we're picking up individuals by screening them.
And once again, if you suspect that it might be the issue, don't stop the gluten before you have the tests.
Right.
Okay.
That's the most important thing so that we can, do the right testing under the right conditions.
Okay. Bob, thank you so much for your call. I'm going to squeeze in Carla from Groveport. Welcome, Carla.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I had some lab work done, and it showed that I wasn't gluten sensitive, but I always felt like I did better, at least avoiding the grains. And then I met a doctor at OSU that said that like 9,500 out of 10,000 of his patients had small bowel damage due to gluten. And so he takes everybody off of gluten. And I'm just wondering, and I'll ask the question then hang up, how common is it to have a false negative on a gluten sensitivity test?
Yeah, so I would say that the testing I'm talking about is specifically for celiac disease because as of now, we have no adequate testing for that entity known as gluten sensitivity or non-celiac gluten sensitivity specifically. So there's a lot of interest in trying to find more specific markers for individuals who may be gluten sensitive but who do not have celiac disease. If you're concerned about celiac disease, the tests that we do are up to 98-99% sensitive and specific, meaning that there are few false positives and few false negatives. But it does happen. And one particular case is individuals who have lower levels of the type of antibody that we look for called IgA, so people who are IgA deficient. If you're only doing a test that looks for that kind of antibody, you may be missed in your diagnosis. But certainly anyone, my practice is anyone who has gastrointestinal symptoms that are severe enough, I'm gonna investigate those, and that may include doing an upper endoscopy with biopsy. But for the vast majority of individuals, the blood tests should be positive prior, and then the biopsy will confirm celiac disease.
Dr. Kupfer, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you so much.
Sonia Kupfer, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Section of Gastroenterology and Center for Clinical Cancer Genetics at the University of Chicago. Coming up, we'll talk to the Chief of the Epidemiology and Prevention Branch at the CDC's Influenza Division about that bird influenza in China. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
Sustaining givers are the future of 89.7 NPR News. A sustainer gives a fixed amount each month. For example, $5, $10, or even $20 per month can be charged to your credit card, and then your membership is always active and your member card renews automatically. Visit wosu.org/sustainer and sign up today.
Support comes from Positively Cleveland, welcoming the Tall Ships Festival on Lake Erie July 3rd through the 7th. And all summer, you can sail 170 feet high on Cedar Point's new roller coaster, The Gatekeeper. Family weekend getaway package information is online at summerincle.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Wellness Wednesday. A couple days ago, China reported three more deaths resulting from the H7N9 bird flu virus. This puts the death toll at 35 and raises the number of infected people to a total of 130. Chinese authorities say the disease is transmitted through chickens only, but the World Health Organization is not so sure. With us with an update on bird flu is the Chief of the Epidemiology and Prevention Branch at the CDC's Influenza Division, Dr. Joseph Bruzzi. Welcome to the show, Dr. Bruzzi.
Thanks.
So I remember the H1N1 swine flu outbreak a few years ago. How does this new bird flu compare to that?
Well, it's different in a couple of ways, but similar in several ways as well. Anytime a new influenza virus like H1N1 in 2009 or this virus in this year emerges, we get worried. We get worried because it has the potential at least to develop into a pandemic or a global epidemic. The H1N1 in 2009 certainly did. It acquired the ability, even though it was a swine origin virus, it acquired the ability to spread between humans, and that's what led to the pandemic. This virus is similar in the sense that it's an animal virus. It seems to be derived from poultry or birds. And it can infect humans, but it hasn't yet acquired that crucial ability to spread easily between humans. So that's really the crucial difference right now.
China's a big place. Is there any concern about how China manages these things and whether or not you can trust what they're coming up with in terms of numbers of cases?
I think what we've observed from China this year and this outbreak particularly, and really in recent years, is much more transparency, much more capability to deal with these sorts of outbreaks and be good global partners. I think that we're confident that China is reporting well. We're confident that they've aggressively looked at this outbreak and are investigating this outbreak. And in fact, CDC has had staff on the ground in Beijing and in the provinces in China assisting them.
H7N9, this bird flu virus, is it a common bird flu virus in and of itself?
Well, it's probably relatively common, at least this type of virus. Bird flu viruses, there's tons of different types, and this H7N9 just indicate one, what we call a subtype of influenza viruses in birds. There are influenza H7N9 viruses in birds all over the world. This particular virus, though, is a new H7N9 virus that we hadn't seen before. It emerged in China just this last month.
Right now, they've just been found in chickens. But does this virus, can it transfer to another kind of bird? Is there any chickens are kind of, they walk around in a pretty stable place. Is there a concern that it can transfer to another kind of bird that can spread it farther and do does it spread to humans from other birds more easily than it does from chickens?
That's a good question. Clearly, avian viruses, avian influenza viruses, can spread to different birds.
Okay.
Absolutely true. And in fact, this virus has been found not only from poultry populations in China, but also from a couple of pigeons, some quails, a couple of ducks. And so clearly this virus is relatively promiscuous among birds. There's always the chance that that the virus will infect a wild bird, a migratory bird, and that bird can take the virus to other places. That's what we think happened in the mid-2000s with the H5N1 avian virus that you might remember. And that virus clearly emerged also in southeastern Asia, but spread pretty rapidly all the way to Asia and northern Africa, potentially through migratory bird flyway patterns. And so the risk is, there's two risks, really, of this virus. One is infecting migratory birds that then take it far away and infect other poultry populations there, but also infecting humans, obviously, where the virus currently is in eastern China.
Are there some birds that we think transfer more easily to humans than others, or is a bird? It doesn't really matter.
Actually, birds aren't all birds. You're right. Some birds will shed more virus than others, but we think that, in fact, if you're a human in China or a human in Vietnam, you have lots of access to poultry. You're around poultry a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You shop in markets, and you're around poultry there, and you may kill your own birds for dinner. And so in that case, the poultry really do represent the greatest risk because humans just have more interaction with them than other birds.
So all in all, well, the number of infected people total 130, the number of deaths 35. How does this rank in terms of our survivability?
Well, it's too early to tell, I think, but clearly this virus, the fact that about 20% of the people who we know that have acquired the virus have died so far, the virus really represents a great concern. We saw that in, again, the avian H5 viruses, where about 50% of the people who get infected die. This is a concerning thing. I think we don't expect this high mortality rates in humans associated with zoonotic viruses or viruses from birds or pigs. That gives us a great concern and the reason we're watching it so closely.
Why do the viruses tend to come from places like China or Vietnam or Asian, Southeast Asia?
It's a good question. And the classical thinking is that the Southeastern Asia has lots of birds, lots of pigs, lots of humans all in close contact. So these viruses, as they mutate, as they share genes with each other between these species, they develop a higher mutation rate or a higher rate of infecting humans with new viruses. But in fact, if you think about the last 100 years or so, it may not be so easy. I mean, the H1N1 virus that emerged in 2009 and caused a global pandemic clearly developed in North America, or the Americas at least. And so I think we shouldn't necessarily blame China or Southeast Asia for all these new viruses. I think they can really come from anywhere.
Not to be too morbid, but what is it about H7N9 that actually kills a person? Were these people who died tend to be, you know, the usual very young or very old?
Yeah, it's a good question. What we know now, at least, the people who are dying tend to be, the people who are infected and getting severely ill and dying tend to be older, and they tend to have underlying health problems, kind of like the people who are at high risk for seasonal flu. You know, in the U.S., if you get flu each year, the regular kind of seasonal flu, most of the people who die, well over 90%, are people over 65, and most of them have underlying diseases that put them at higher risk. That looks to be the same case with this virus. About half the patients are over 60, and a lot of those patients have underlying diseases that put them at higher risk for severe disease. And so that's we think that this virus probably is causing a lot of severe disease because it's infecting a lot of older people, for one.
You know, it's always difficult for untrained people like me and everybody else out there to figure out whether this is something to be concerned about. And even if it is, what can we do from our vantage point at this time?
Yeah, it's a good point. And I want to stress a couple of things. First, that the virus hasn't been seen anywhere outside China so far. We're doing good surveillance in the surrounding countries and in the U.S., to detect the introduction of this virus in the U.S. We haven't seen any so far. So that being the case, our only recommendations right now are is if you go to China, and we're not recommending you don't, If you go to China, just stay away from bird markets and poultry, and that probably should do enough to reduce your risk of acquiring this infection. In the United States, the key is really to stay to pay attention to what we're saying, hopefully, but also paying attention to what your local county health folks and state health officials are saying about the virus. We don't think anybody needs to take any special precautions at this point.
My guest is Dr. Joseph Bruzzi. He's chief of the Epidemiology and Prevention Branch at CDC's Influenza Division. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. So you said you're not dissuading people or not discouraging people from traveling to China yet.
We're not. If you look at the distribution of this disease, both in birds and in humans in China, it's really isolated to a certain part of China. And even there, of 130 cases, it's in a population of several hundred million people. And we think that the cases so far have been associated with close exposure to poultry. And so I think the traveler to China from America who doesn't go to poultry markets, who doesn't kill their own birds for dinner, et cetera, and doesn't have that sort of intense exposure to poultry populations in China, I think are at really, really low risk. And so just use common sense. Wash your hands a lot. You know, stay away from poultry. If you're around sick people, make sure you wash your hands and ask them to cover their cough, things like that.
In China, what is the mood there? What do we know about how people respond in China when these things hit?
I think the Chinese citizens are taking this very seriously, and I think you see that already in things like reduced consumption or reduced demand for poultry since this started. I think the Chinese citizens, I think, are mindful that poultry may carry a risk of transmitting this virus, and you've seen less poultry eaten, less poultry consumed. I think that said, as this virus, as the human cases tail off now, which they have, probably as a result partially of the closure of live poultry markets in major cities in eastern China, I think you'll see an increased consumption of poultry again. And so it's always hard to change behaviors quickly related to these outbreaks.
When the birds get the virus, do they get sick or are they just carrying something?
They don't get sick, and that's an important thing to talk about, actually. In several of these avian viruses, like the H5N1 avian viruses that have caused deaths in Asia and worldwide since 2003 or so, those viruses are called highly pathogenic avian viruses. And what that means is if a bird, if a poultry or a quail or a duck are infected with those viruses, they die, and they die quickly, and they're noticeably sick. And so humans tend to stay away from them or can stay away from them and don't eat them, things like that. These viruses, these H7N9 viruses, actually don't cause any symptoms or very mild symptoms in poultry populations. So you wouldn't know they're sick, and this really represents a huge problem for public health. You don't have a sentinel. You don't have a signal that there's a risk to being around poultry because these poultry are completely well.
So when they do find one that tests positive for the virus, do they just kill all the birds that have been around it?
Yeah, that's the recommendation, that if in your surveillance you test these birds and you find positive that a bird population or a market or a flock has positive birds in it, culling those birds, decontaminating that area, and warning people that have been exposed to those birds to watch out for onset of illness are all good public health approaches to limiting spread.
Every year the CDC encourages us to get a flu shot. How likely is a bird flu vaccine? Would this be something that would be put into the regular flu shot?
It probably wouldn't be put into the regular flu shot, but it's something we're working very actively and very rapidly to create. In fact, anytime a new flu virus emerges anywhere in the world, one of the things that CDC does is begin to make a vaccine against it, and mostly as a preparatory activity. And we don't know, we haven't decided we're going to make a lot of this vaccine. We certainly haven't decided that the vaccine will be given to a lot of people. But the vaccine production from start to finish takes several months.
Mm-hmm.
And so just to be safe, each time one of these things emerges, we get the virus, we begin to make a vaccine, and we start to share that vaccine strain with manufacturers all around the world so that they can start to think about making a vaccine. So we're ahead of the game if this virus poses a more of a threat.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say I made the mistake of watching part of Contagion last night, that movie. So kind of primed the pump here. But in that movie, that sort of operation took place. They sent it out, and places all over the world were working on a vaccine, including private manufacturers and private labs.
That's right.
Right.
And that happens. That happens every year for seasonal virus. We make a we recommend viruses and provide viruses to the manufacturers to make the regular flu vaccine. Mm-hmm. We do the same thing in cases like this where there's a novel virus that emerges that represents a pandemic threat.
And just out of curiosity, how's this past season been?
It was a severe flu season. Actually, mm-hmm. we had lots of deaths among elderly people this last year. And lots of disease, and it was a really early year. We saw lots of disease in around Christmas time and the New Year's, which is a little earlier than usual. We don't know what that means for next year, and because we don't know what that means for next year, we remind everybody every chance we get to make sure they get their vaccine early in the fall.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Bruzzi, for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Dr. Joseph Bruzzi, he's chief of the Epidemiology and Prevention Branch in CDC's Influenza Division. Coming up, Gretchen Reynolds, columnist from the New York Times Well blog, will be talking about exercise. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from On the Square Yoga, offering 45-minute midday yoga classes at 11, noon, and 1 in downtown Columbus. On the Square Yoga, located at 65 East State Street between the Ohio Theater and the Sheraton, making yoga accessible to everybody. More at onthesquareyoga.com.
When filmmaker and actor Sarah Polley was growing up, her family would joke,
"I didn't look much like my father. My dad probably wasn't my real dad."
Polly was 11 when her mother died with a secret. Years later, Polly went looking for the real story of her mother's life and in the process discovered her father wasn't her father. On the next Fresh Air, Polly talks about her documentary, Stories We Tell. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with a 2013 wellness series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's wellness series are at go.osu.edu/series.
The WOSU Member Card Benefit of the Month for May is the Gateway Film Center. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission all month long. Visit WOSU.org.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. 7 minutes. You could probably endure anything for just 7 minutes, even if it's a steadily unpleasant set of 7 minutes and designed to instill discomfort. That's the description of the new 7-minute workout that's been gaining popularity, but it is not for the faint of heart, literally. Our fitness research expert, Gretchen Reynolds of the New York Times Well blog, joins us now to tell us whether these might be minutes well spent. Welcome, Gretchen.
Thanks for having me.
7 minutes, you know, I wish I, you know, I think I could use this seven minute workout. What do you recommend, or what is the recommendation for using this kind of workout?
Well, this particular workout is a series of actually 12 exercises, and if someone is interested in the exact exercises, I'd recommend they get on the Well blog of the New York Times.
There's a really nice illustration.
Exactly, mm-hmm. That shows you that they're very basic exercises, jumping jacks, push-ups, crunches, that sort of thing. But they have been put in a very specific order. What this exercise, the whole program, is essentially a very concentrated kind of high-intensity interval training, which has been shown in the past few years to be a really potent and effective kind of exercise. It does allow you to get essentially the same physiological benefits as a much, much longer period of running, cycling, swimming, or doing basic weight training. You basically squish all of that into a very short period of time, but you have to do it hard.
Do you have to do it every day?
No. I mean, as with any exercise program, this particular one, how often you need to do it, how hard you need to do it, partly depends on your own exercise goals. I mean, if your plan is to run a marathon, then this will not be sufficient anyway. if your plan is to live a longer, healthier, more fit life, then you could do this 3 times a week and get enormous benefits. If you do it every day, you're going to get more benefits. If you do it more than once a day, you'll get more benefits. But if you have 7 minutes and you can do these 12 exercises, and each one you only do for 30 seconds, mm-hmm. you can do it in your office. But that's why I wrote about this particular program. It's not because it's the only exercise program that will work. It is a beautifully designed program that you can do in your office, your living room, a hotel room. It will provide a really good full body exercise regimen, and it will improve both your aerobic fitness and your muscular strength. I do have to say, it made me tired.
I'm going to try it. My guest is Gretchen Reynolds, columnist for the New York Times Well blog. We're talking about exercise, as we always do with Gretchen. If you have a question or comment for her, want to share your exercise routine, it's always fun to hear what people are out there doing. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you have tried the 7-minute workout and want to share your response, or, you know, what your experience was with us, we'd really appreciate that. Once again, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So the 12 exercises, this is one of my things, is tortures me when I see somebody doing an exercise incorrectly. When I see somebody spending all the effort to do a squat incorrectly or a push-up incorrectly.
Not only are they potentially wasting time, but they are also probably courting injury. I mean, with the 7-minute workout or with any kinds of exercise, especially body weight training, it is really important that you know how to do an exercise correctly. And I would very strongly urge someone who's not familiar with just how to do a squat correctly, arrange just one meeting with a good trainer. You can find personal trainers. You can also find people who are certified athletic trainers. And that means they have a lot of really strong academic training in how to do exercises safely and correctly. You can find a local certified trainer online. You also can, and I've used this resource, you can use YouTube, which is actually generally quite good. Mm-hmm. You do want to find videos that have been posted by people who are certified athletic trainers, mm-hmm. not your next-door neighbor. But there's a surprising wealth of really good information on YouTube about how to do exercises safely and well.
There's got to be an app out there.
darn it. There are multiple apps. Many, many apps. Again, look for someone who has credentials, mm-hmm. not just someone who has decided that this is a quick way to make some money. There are some really good apps for programs very similar to this one. There will undoubtedly be an app that is exactly this program very soon. If it comes from a source that either has some sort of certification or has academic credentials, that would be a source and an app that I would trust. If it just comes from someone whose credentials you don't recognize, mm-hmm. find a different app.
Okay. Lori and Powell, you're on the air with Gretchen Reynolds. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I love this conversation, and I would so very much like to just make my life more active so I didn't have to do this, but I'm glad to hear that there are quick ways to handle it. My problem is, and I know I've been told it's a good thing, is when I exercise, I get sweaty. So how do you deal with doing this very intense 7-minute exercise without, you know, having to, like if you do it in the office or something, without needing to take a shower and wash your hair and all that stuff afterwards?
Well, I would say go to your office manager and suggest they put in a shower. and that's actually not facetious. There are a lot of corporate wellness programs where they can, and where the company itself can get reductions in the cost of corporate health care if they do things like even put in one shower. If they put in a shower for a man, a shower for women, there frequently are reductions in how much that company will pay for the health care that you are contributing to. It's not just for your particular convenience. It actually, if it can promote wellness among the people, it pays off big time. So that would be my first suggestion, is actually talk to them about putting in a shower. The second is go to the bathroom and lock the door, which I have done before, and do a bird bath. I mean, you know, it's not ideal, but it can be done. There's no way to avoid sweating if you want to actually get the benefits.
All right. Well, Lori, thanks. And if you try it, let us know next time Gretchen's on how it worked.
You bet. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Again, that number 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. When you're doing the 7-minute workout, Gretchen, how much time between each task?
Well, it's set up. There are 12 exercises, and again, this was not I didn't develop this. It was developed by a group of people with some really good scientific grounding, and the idea is to move from one exercise to the next with about 30 seconds between, which is how it winds up being 7 minutes. With about 10 seconds between.
Okay.
And each exercise itself is 30 seconds, so you're moving fast. But again, the only equipment that you need, since this is all body weight based, is you need a wall, so you can do some wall squats, and you need a chair, because you do go up on the chair at one point. You can do it in your office, I know, because I have. I wrote about this because I so often write about things abstractly, like high-intensity interval training, that it is a wonderful way to, in a short period of time, improve your fitness. This is a concrete example of how to do that in a really easy, intuitive way and get both muscular improvements and endurance improvements. And that it's a really good way to start. If you're not familiar with things like how to do intervals, if you're not familiar with things like resistance training, if you are, certainly this is not the only exercise program. It's also not the only thing I would ever recommend people do. It's a very easy, concentrated program. If you do it twice a week, you will be in better shape than you are now.
Well, my husband's stuck in a hotel room this week, so I'm going to email it to him because it frustrates him when you get out of your routine. Phil in Grandview, you're on the air with Gretchen Reynolds. Welcome, Phil.
Hey, good morning. I'm 53. I'm in pretty good shape. And I'd seen this article actually in the Times over the weekend and clipped it. I went running this morning up at the school track and then did this set of exercises, and now I was already sweating, but it's a great workout, and I really liked it. I was able to use the bleachers as my stairs to do step ups, and there was a flagpole there, and I used that to do a wall sit. But I oftentimes do a set of 10 exercises in the morning, 1 minute each. It's a very similar concept, but what's really neat about it is it works all the major muscle groups and in a particular order. And what I find is in the morning, I break a slight sweat when I do that, and then I get in the shower. But it really boosts my metabolism and for the whole day. So really, really neat set of exercises.
All right.
That's wonderful. I've actually gotten a number of comments from people who are already in pretty good shape who've said that they have then done, as your caller just did, tacked this on the end of a pre-existing endurance program and found that it's a very good way to make yourself even more tired at the end and to make sure that you're getting some good resistance weight training in addition to running or cycling. So if you're already in really good shape, this could be a wonderful adjunct. Again, the nice thing about this program, and I'm just so you know, I don't get more money for talking about this
program. I know.
Program.
In fact, it's competing with your 20-minute workout book.
Exactly. It is. In this case, the really nice thing is how contained it is. I mean, you don't need to bring equipment.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it in a really small space. You can do it with nothing but your own body. And I think that's really liberating. People need to remember that you don't have to have a gym membership. You don't have to have a lot of training. All you need to do is use your own body, and you can actually wind up in really good shape.
Okay. Phil, thanks for the review. Derek in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Derek.
Hey. Hi, Ann. Long-time listener, off and on when I can get out of work and trying to sneak to the radio.
Thank you.
I wanted to comment on something that your speaker said, and then she kept saying more points, really good points, and so I kept wanting to comment. So I can't really say all of them, but one of the big things that I thought was really cool is the two big ones was she was talking about using just your body, and then also the workout being like a great adjunct to whatever you're already doing. Mm-hmm. I work at Ohio State, and some of the doctors sometimes, because I'm very fit, and they'll ask, you know, hey, yeah, you know, what are you eating or what are you doing? And I'll say, well, I always ask, what are you currently doing? And they'll say, you know, usually it's long distance running over and over and over again. I say, well, you know, just add some intervals. And it's great that, you concentrate on that. And your other caller talked about, you know, he's doing his own intervals. And there's, you know, when you talk about intervals, it's just a frame of time. So it could be split up in any way you want. And originally why I called was there's a program or a little workout that's about 8 minutes long. It's Tabata training, and it's by Dr. Izumi Tabata.
Mm-hmm.
And all it is very similar, you know, certain period on, certain period off. But a lot of people have been using it with combined exercises or different exercises the same way that you were talking about using 12 exercises. But there's a lot of information. On that specific style, and they studied it a lot, and so there's a lot of published articles, things mm-hmm. like that, to review risks or benefits from that style of training. But it's the same type of thing.
Okay. Well, Derek, thanks. Now get back to work. No.
and I would say, as the caller points out, what this program and many similar programs are doing is following essentially a template where you do an exercise or an activity hard for a brief period of time, then easy for a period of time, then hard for a period of time. That's mm-hmm. interval training. And you can, if you are clever and willing, you can develop almost any sort of exercise program on your own. A lot of people don't want to do that. They do want to be told mm-hmm. this particular program will work all of the muscles in your body. It follows the correct order, and that's really why we publish this, is for people who basically want to be told how to do this well and easily. If you're well informed, you can develop your own program, and I'm all in favor of that. I think it's great. But for people who want a little more guidance, that's what this provides, and it just, I mean, I hope it does help people find a way to fit exercise into their life, because
everyone really can find 7 minutes.
Derek, thanks a lot for your call. It seems to be jumping jacks, then the wall sit. Push-ups, then the abdominal crunch. Step up onto the chair, then the squat. Tricep dip. Ugh, I hate that. Then I do. It's one of my worst ones. Then the plank. It seems like it's movement, resistance, movement, resistance. Or there seems to be a pattern there.
Well, and they're also, although this may be more subtle, the designers very carefully created it so that, in effect, you work the upper body and then the lower body.
Okay.
So that you are actually providing a rest period for each of those muscles in addition to that little 10-second rest period. So there are sort of interval rest periods built into how the exercise program is structured, which I found to be quite clever. And I would not have known how to do that had I structured the program myself. That's exactly what I wanted out of it, was an understanding of why these exercises are being done or promoted in this order. And there is a scientific grounding for that. And it's not mine. It's based on good, solid science. Though, again, anyone could substitute out the exercises that you really hate or that hurt, or if you have a bad back.
No, I'm not. I'll do the triceps. I know they're good for me, particularly at my age. Real quick, if you know, for people who'd rather sit around than exercise, as this was put to me, is an exercise ball any better to sit on than a chair at work? Do you have any thoughts about exercise balls? Not the weight balls, but the big bouncy ones.
Right, that people think are going to give them a full core workout while they're sitting there.
Yeah.
The evidence is that is not true.
Okay.
There's very little additional muscle activation in your core when you sit on that, on a ball, and there's some evidence that it actually contributes to lower back and backside pain, especially when people first start sitting on them. And when I first started sitting on one, my dog brought a thorn in and the ball exploded. My husband found very amusing, but I didn't.
We hear a lot about the benefits of cardio exercise for stress reduction and memory increase. Mm-hmm. Does weightlifting offer the same kind of benefits? Do we know whether that's the case?
Yes. Okay. In a word, in both people and in animals, there's very good evidence that weight training has a very significant effect on your brain. It does increase the number of brain cells that you are creating. It does lead to stress reduction. But what's interesting is it does that through a different mechanism than, say, aerobic exercise.
Okay.
So if you do both, there's very good reason to think you'll get even more benefits. Your brain will be healthier in multiple ways. So one more reason to do this little 7-minute thing.
Yeah.
It is both weight training and endurance in one session.
Well, Gretchen Reynolds, thanks for joining us again today. As always, a pleasure.
It was my pleasure, too. Thanks for having me.
Gretchen Reynolds, she's author of The 20-Minute Workout. She's also a columnist for the New York Times Well blog. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I thank you so much. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.